Welcome to Pod of Orcas. I'm Justin Cox, and I'm here with Sea Doc Society board member Kevin Campion. As always, Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really good today. I'm pretty stoked to talk about Jason Colby here. That might have been a spoiler alert, but yeah, I'm great.
It says it in the episode title, so I think people got it. As you said, we're talking to Jason Colby, who is a history professor at the University of Victoria, among other things. He's also an author, and a very good author. His most recent book, I believe, is Orca: How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. And in this episode, we kind of follow human perception of orcas over time. And Kevin, what was like the kind of initial perception of orcas by, honestly, European white people that came to this area?
They were just viewed as this sort of ruthless predator that, I think a lot of the perception really came out of like the whalers and people like observing orcas killing like these big, larger whales, you know, blue whales or humpbacks or whatever, which is like a pretty violent act, you know. And I think they just wrap that all up in your standard, like, oh, I'm afraid of carnivores and afraid of predators that has persisted forever.
This book follows the way we've perceived orcas over time, from beasts that needed to be killed to amazing smart animals that could be kept in tanks for a show to amazing smart animals that should be out in the wild. And oh my God, why are we putting these animals in captivity? Which is kind of where we are now. Yeah.
I like can't say enough about how much inspiration I take from that change of perception and more, I think, from the timeline that it happened. Over, you know, he mentions this, you bring it up, people's perception of these whales, and with it kind of whales in general, flipped so, you know, just over the course of 10 years, 20 years, something like that. Like, that is an amazing thing.
It's an amazing story because you're getting this thing told from the perspective of a kid whose dad worked in that world that was part of the process of taking whales into captivity, who's then kind of recounting it as a historian. And also you're hearing a bit about the evolution of his dad's kind of like feelings about what he was a part of over time. And you hear from some of these people that were involved in that toward the end of the book in ways that I think, and we get to it toward the end of our interview, that are pretty affecting. I get a little bit of chills talking about it.
Seeing the pace that change happened and thinking about some other like big environmental issues that we have, climate change being the first one that pops into mind. And if the information is presented in the right way, like we as a culture can change and quickly if we need to. And that's a pretty powerful message.
Okay, so I'm going to kick it over to Jason Colby. You can get the free Sea Doc Society newsletter at seadocsociety.org/newsletter to follow what's happening with the whales and this ecosystem, the Salish Sea, as a whole. You can also find us on all the social media apps. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Give it a rating and a review. That helps other people find it. Tell a friend about it. And let's continue to tell the story of this cool species. Without further ado, here is Jason Colby. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Justin.
This series is made possible by our amazing sponsors: Shearwater Kayak Tours, Rain Shadow Solar, Two Beers Brewing Company, Deer Harbor Charters and the Averna family, Betsy Wareham and West Sound Marina, the San Juan County Marine Resources Committee, and Apple State Vinegar. Thank you also to an anonymous donor who sponsored in the memory of Nancy Albach. We are a science-based organization on Orcas Island, and we are part of the Karen C. Dreyer Wildlife Health Center at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Jason Colby, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be with you.
Jason is the author of Orca: How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator, which is a very cool book. I'm curious if this book was something that was kind of in the back of your head for a long time, because a quick parenthetical, like, you have a background in history and you're a very natural storyteller in a way that I think this book is jam-packed with, like, citations. It's very rooted in the history of this species. But you have a personal story connected to it. So it's like, you have this skill set in history, but also you're kind of telling a personal story. And I'm just curious how you ended up there.
That's a great way to put it, actually. I do have a very personal connection to this story, having grown up on both sides of the border in the Salish Sea, my father being deeply involved in this story, in this industry in the 1970s. Growing up, I watched him be haunted by that story as people became more and more fond of orcas in the region, and a lot of that guilt about his past history in this really started to show, I think, certainly when I was growing up, in the 1980s and early 90s. And so I'd say that even though I went on to become a historian, went to graduate school and got my PhD in history, it did a different project for my first book, entirely different project about the banana industry in Central America. This was a story that was knocking around in my head, probably my whole life, that I needed to wrestle with.
So a major takeaway for me in reading the book is it's a complicated history, because there a lot of the reason that we feel the way we feel about killer whales now, or the popular perception of killer whales in the Pacific Northwest, has to do with capture and captivity, which is itself a sad part of history. But the perception we have now wouldn't be the perception we have if not for people connecting individually with these animals and the science that came as a result of being around these animals while alive for the first time ever. How's that sound as a takeaway for someone having freshly read the book?
When you're writing history, when you're researching history, you come upon and have to confront these nuances and complexities and paradoxes constantly. It's very rarely a case of the black hats and the white hats and, the clear villains and the clear heroes. And, in this case, the history of orca capture and captivity in the Pacific Northwest is what I often refer to as an unthinkable history for the region. It's a dark history that a lot of people in the region, either don't know about, or want to forget, or often displace onto forces from outside the region like SeaWorld. But it was actually, Pacific Northwesterners that sort of drove this story. And, at the heart of it, the transformation and the context I try to show is that, our relationship to animals more broadly, but certainly to marine wildlife up until the mid to late 1960s, certainly was really shaped by the extractive economy of the Pacific coast. And so, when people are looking at animals and marine life in particular, salmon, even fur seals and such, and even great whales as sources of commodities and making a living, then you tend to view predators like orcas as threats, either to your living or to yourself. And so even in this region where we think about ourselves as very, very fond, and we are very, very fond of the orcas that spend much of their time in this area, it wasn't always like that. And it's actually a very, very brief time ago in the span of history that people were eliminating marine mammals, were targeting killer whales for elimination, were, shooting and harassing them for fun or out of fear. And it was actually this process of live capture that transformed that.
Yeah, so let's go there. So you kind of start the book by going much further back in time to sort of talk about these species and just perception of killer whales and whales in general. But then the speed with which perceptions change from like the 60s through the next, it's like really in just a matter of decades. How do they go from being killer whales or Cygnus orca, demon from the netherworld, to take us through the 60s to the 80s, 90s, and maybe even all the way up to blackfish and now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd start off by saying that, it's important to contextualize this about sort of indigenous history in the region first. And, a lot of people assume that there's sort of a uniform fondness and close relationship between indigenous peoples in the area and orcas and other marine life. But, it's complicated and shaped by their economics and cultures, depending on where they were. And so you know, there were different relationships that indigenous peoples had with in the area, depending on whether they were mostly, you know, reef net fishers or river fishers or whalers in the case of the Nuchalnuth and the Macaw. You know, the Macaw, for example, actually hunted orcas on occasion. But there was, you know, prior to sort of European settlement, there was a general perception of orcas as, along with other, you know, marine life, as having a place here, having a place and, you know, in a sense, a right to exist and the right to their space and their living. And so in lots of ways, the extractive economy I was talking about before sort of unsettles that and challenges that. And so to get back to your question, I just wanted that context in there first. We do see a really rapid transformation, you know, in the mid to late 1960s of you know, going from in this region, but also around the world, generally seeing orcas as indistinguishable black and white masses with terrifying teeth. And this was actually, you know, the description of them and the floating assumptions about them were not just that they were mysterious and frightening, but in fact dangerous to people. You know, their stories never confirmed of them attacking people, you know, in the wild. And what we see happen, and it's driven in the north, it's really driven by events in the Northwest, is this rapid transformation in human perceptions of and relationships to killer whales. And at the heart of it is a couple accidental but also intentional captures of orcas alive for the very first time, as opposed to being shot, you know, and hunted or being killed by scientists, which was the only form of science in the region until then. And at the heart of this, I would argue, is as you, and we see this actually in other dynamics in other forms of captivity, is as you bring animals into human space, into urban space, you know, the first captivity of an orca of any length is in Vancouver, you know, 1964, the animal known as Moby Doll. And then the following year in Seattle, the Seattle Marine Aquarium brings another orca accidentally captured by fishermen in 1965 named Nemu. And in these cases, what we see is the close interaction with an individual orca in a captive setting doesn't just show people that these are not kind of mindless killing machines that will attack people at a moment's notice and given any chance, but that these are individual creatures with their own personalities, their own quirks. And once you make that step from thinking about animals as indistinguishable and dangerous in the wild to individual and having a name and interacting with you on an individual basis, it's part of a breaking down, I would argue, of to a certain degree of the species divide.
You know, when you talk about Ted Griffin getting in the water with Nemu off right there in Seattle and a bunch of people seeing that, that's a flashpoint. That's a huge perception shift.
It is, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, if you were to point to one moment in this story that is transformative for both popular views, cultural understandings of orcas, but also scientific perceptions as well, it is early September of 1965 when Ted Griffin, the owner of the Seattle Marine Aquarium, slips into the water with Nemu, this large male orca captured in BC. And in contrast to the predictions of scientists, journalists, and others, Nemu doesn't tear him limb from limb, but actually lets him swim around in the pool with him and eventually lets him brush him, touch him, and indeed even ride him. And these are often, these events are often framed in the present context by the criticism of the captivity industry, and understandably so. But at the time, it's really important to understand that the debate, when Ted Griffin slipped into the water with Nemu, the debate was not between whale watching and whale catching. It was between whale catching and whale killing. And it's an entirely different framing or optic of a relationship with an orca than anyone had ever seen before. I mean, this is the first time that we know of that any human being had ever swam with and certainly touched and rode an orca. And it doesn't just make big news in the Northwest. I mean, Griffin goes on to write a very prominent article in National Geographic that's read by hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, entitled Making Friends with a Killer Whale, that appears in 1966. And it's really the launching point for a lot of the young people that read that. Those, a lot of them go on to become orca scientists later in life.
Yeah, you talk about that. You put something so compelling into the head of a curious, potential aspiring scientist, and you're going to put some people on a path. And it sounds like that happened. You said, it sounds like many scientists you talk to reference that article, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Ken Balcom is a great example. You know, Ken Balcom, who runs the Center for Whale Research on San Juan Island, cites that article. He was not a kid at the time. You know, he was an adult, but he cites that as a sort of transformative a moment for him reading that. And then many others, you know, John Ford, who goes on to be a specialist in orca acoustics, actually goes and sees Moby Doll in Vancouver when he's a 9-year-old. You know, Paul Spong gets his start at the Vancouver Aquarium, working with captive orcas, and large numbers of US-based scientists actually get their first chance to see and interact with a live killer whale up close at the Seattle, on the Seattle waterfront. And we take this for granted now, and I think a lot of people assume that in those days, scientists went out like they do now and observe wild whales, you know, from a distance, and you know, try to use a variety of methods, unobtrusive methods, to do their research. But in fact, most science until the mid to late 1960s was of the kill and dissect variety. Most whale scientists are working on whale stations, right, and actually killing and dissecting orcas even. So this is an entirely new way for scientists to perceive and interact with them as well.
Yeah, I mean, you say that once a live whale was in captivity, that's the first time they can fully confirm the echolocation, way they communicate and everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, our textbooks about marine mammals, especially small cetaceans, are filled with research that was sparked, derived, and really launched from captivity. You know, the confirmation of that bottlenose dolphins use echolocation was proved in captivity. Likewise with orcas, and first study of their diving physiology and such. And so much of what we actually know of the physiology of cetaceans, you know, comes from these early captive studies. And that's not to say that research in captivity now has that same compelling case to be made, but rather this is making a historical point that this was transformative, not just for human perceptions of killer whales, but actually for scientific interactions with them.
You bring a lot of this nuance and sort of like the way things were perceived, the way that someone like Ted Griffin hopping in the water with Namu at that time is much different than we would see it now. Are you able to have those conversations about captivity with people who are, I mean, obviously, like you just said, there are a lot of reasons to be anti-captivity. The whole perception has changed. You couldn't make the same case now. Do you find that people respond with an open mind to that nuanced perspective, historical perspective that you share in the book? Or, yeah, I don't even know. I think you know what I'm kind of going for, but like, yeah. How has the response been from anti-captivity people to a book that paints in the shades of gray like this?
Well, you know that we're living in a highly polarized time, right? When people tend to read a snippet or not even a blurb about something and judge it and decide whether it's 100% right or 100% wrong.
Yep.
I would say that for people that have actually read the book and have come to my talks, the response has been really wonderful because they understand what I'm doing and how I'm trying to, you know, help us understand this really iconic relationship we've developed with orcas, but also understand the complicated history and the shared responsibility we have toward the species and especially the populations in the Northwest that paid the price for our education. And so I think when people hear that, they understand it. There's definitely, I mean, you can look up, you know, reviews of my book, and you can definitely see people who have decided that they hated the ideas that I'm pursuing and the sort of the questions I'm pursuing even before they open the book. And you always run into that. But, you know, I think people that have read it carefully or have listened to me understand that, you know, the purpose of the book is not to make an apology or a defense of the captivity industry, neither its history nor its present, but rather to understand how interwoven that history is with with how we feel about not just orcas, but marine life now. And so it was a question of how much I should put myself and my father's story and my family story into the book, precisely because, you know, there was a concern that people would see that my father had this own history, you know, participating in captures on both sides of the border, and immediately decide that this is just a book trying to sort of whitewash that history. Of course, if you actually read the book, you know, I'm wrestling in a really difficult way, I think, with the costs of this history, especially for killer whales. You know, I mean, and the book wraps up with a bit of a requiem for my own family's role in the plight of southern resident killer whales. I wouldn't put that in if I was trying to celebrate the captivity industry. But I also don't think it helps anyone to you know, villainize others, and certainly not to villainize those that came before us. And so it was my hope that people of different generations in the Northwest would read it and be able to understand one another a little bit better, as opposed to the sort of black and white villainization.
It's history, right? And the purpose of history is to understand the past, to have a sense of what to do next, right? Or to look ahead. And sometimes that past is ugly, or that past is just complicated, but you have to have an accurate understanding of it to look ahead. And the undeniable truth is that captivity, this did happen. And you can't lie to yourself and say that we didn't learn things about killer whales from captivity. It doesn't, you don't, that doesn't need to be a defense of captivity, but it's just true.
Certainly not a defense of captivity now. Right. And I think that people often make that conflation that I never intended, which is, you know, looking at the history of captivity and its transformative impact is not necessarily a case that it should continue in the way it did in the past into 2020, right? But I think that what you were just discussing there about the purpose of history is right on. And I often liken this, you know, in an oversimplified way, sure, to going to a therapist, right? As an individual, you know, and you can talk through your past, your own personal past and failings and mistakes and scars, and wrestle with it and try to move forward as a better person, or you can avoid that. You can project, as many people often do, you know, your mistakes and your angst and your guilt about those onto other people, and it's not the most positive path forward for you. And so as a society, and certainly I thought about this regionally to a great extent, you know, the transnational region in the Salish Sea, I wanted people to wrestle with our own shared and broader and deeper regional responsibility for the crisis that southern resident orcas are facing, rather than displace and project it, as we often do, onto SeaWorld, onto the Miami Sea Aquarium, which holds the last southern resident killer whale in captivity, Lolita or Tokutai. I think it's really easy for people to sort of point to those distant institutions and say they're the problem, they're the reason why our southern resident killer whales are in danger of extinction. But really, in so many ways, it's us, right? And it's not just the capture industry that and the damage it did, but the damage that we've done as consumers and residents of this area to this iconic population.
I think you get to that in the epilogue of the book, that it's like, the major threat now is not Sea Aquarium or SeaWorld, it's the people who live here. There are 100,000 people for every southern resident killer whale, and that just illustrates how complex the problem is. But it forces you to confront the question and forces you to confront the fact that there are a lot of, I don't know, things happening at the same time here that make this a complicated situation.
Hi, this is Bob Friel, producer of the SeaDoc Society's video series, Salish Sea Wild. Follow SeaDoc's Joe Gatos as he explores the wonders of the Salish Sea. Watch Joe shake hands with the world's biggest octopus and witness our wildest wildlife events. To see the show, just go to YouTube and search for Salish Sea Wild. Don't miss the episode where Dr. Joe makes a house call to check on the health of our beloved southern resident killer whales.
I want to ask about this moment in the mid-70s, or this moment in the 70s where SeaWorld comes to Puget Sound, it's just sort of an incredible scene. What's kind of the backdrop of this I think it's basically what kind of puts an end to Capture Him captivity in the state. If you were making it up, this almost sounds too hard to believe.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of cinematic moments in this book, and I'm not saying that to pump myself up as a writer, but rather to say that you know, there are a lot of scenes that I felt like, you know, almost wrote themselves with how sort of visual and striking they were, and this one, you know, the capture in Bud Inlet in southern Puget Sound in March of 1976 is definitely one of these where, you know, if you indeed tried to pitch this as a movie idea, someone, you know, an executive would find this implausible. And it's really at the heart of it is the story of live capture. It had its high point in the late 60s and early 70s, especially in Puget Sound. Some really, you know, contentious events happen, including the rounding up of nearly all of the southern residents, you know, by Ted Griffin's company, which releases almost all of them, but still, you know, there are many taken out for captivity and several that are killed in the process accidentally. And Ted Griffin leaves the business in 1972. His partner, Don Goldsberry, also based in Seattle, you know, takes over the Seattle Marine Aquarium, takes over its capture operation, NAMU Incorporated. And that, in the process of the mid-1970s, is taken over by SeaWorld, which is looking for a capture platform to be able to supply not just its San Diego franchise, but it's opened up a new franchise in Ohio as well.
Yeah.
So it's looking for a reliable supply. And that team, owned by SeaWorld, but really it's still staffed by the Northwesterners and the fishermen and such who had done the previous captures, makes a capture in Bud Inlet right off of the Washington State Capitol of Olympia. And, you know, as luck would have it, or serendipity would have it, this is just days, within days of when legislators in Olympia at that state capitol are debating the possibility of making Puget Sound a whale sanctuary, an orca sanctuary. And it's also just a couple days before an orca symposium is scheduled to be held just a couple of miles away at Evergreen State College. And so all of these events sort of collide or intersect to create this extraordinary moment where the SeaWorld team captures most of a pod of what we now know are transient or mammal eating Biggs killer whales, and try to hold them there to select them out, to measure which ones they can take under regulations to take back to SeaWorld. And while this is happening, protesters start surrounding the capture site in kayaks and on the beach and start demanding the whales release. And even more sort of serendipitously, when the capture had happened, an aide to Governor Dan Evans, Ralph Monroe, the longstanding now former Secretary of State of Washington, was out on a boat with friends when this happened. And so he rushes to the governor and to Attorney General Slade Gordon and asks them to intervene, which they do. They end up suing the U.S. government, which had given SeaWorld the permits for the capture, as well as SeaWorld. And it becomes this extraordinary drama played out, not just in the courts in Seattle, but on the front pages of Seattle newspapers, the Post Intelligencer or in the Seattle Times. And it's this extraordinary moment where I think a lot of people, and certainly in Western Washington, express their conviction that this kind of relationship, this kind of violent, you know, rounding up of an increasingly iconic species is simply not acceptable to them, and they're going to oppose it. And eventually they drive SeaWorld out. SeaWorld agrees never to catch killer whales in Washington state waters again.
This directly leads to like concrete policy in the next couple of years, right?
There's you know, continuing issuing of permits and captures. You know, SeaWorld's going to go to Iceland, sort of out of the public eye, to capture killer whales for their facilities, but also going to try to go on to Alaska in the early 1980s. But it's actually that this sort of searing moment, this capture in Bud Inlet right next to Olympia, that galvanizes a lot of activists, and, you know, among them Ralph Monroe, you know, who then intervene and try to stop SeaWorld wherever it goes. And so It galvanizes activists, and it also makes government regulators, you know, increasingly more leery of issuing these kind of capture permits. Especially, I should emphasize, capture permits where facilities like SeaWorld could collect wildlife within public view. I mean, I think that's one of the huge transformative aspects of this, is that, you know, these captures were happening in the Salish Sea, in the view of the public. And they were spectacles of violence in the eyes of many people. You know, and of course, whaling is still taking place offshore, but it's outside the public view. And whereas these are, you know, in an area where there are increasing numbers of, you know, recreational boaters out, you know, on the waters, and they're there to enjoy sea life and not watch it sort of traumatized and captured.
This podcast is kind of in the tradition of, I think that telling stories just really matters, and I personally am extremely fascinated in it. Obviously, you are as well. A thing I really enjoy about the book is that it's basically gathering and rounding up all these other pieces of culture, whether it's movies, or documentaries, or just documented moments, or National Geographic articles, or what's the smutty magazine?
Stag magazine with the cover of the menacing killer whale attacking the two shirtless guys on a life raft.
I think you talk about, like, this is, what do you talk about the connection to the Navy with that?
Yeah, well, that's a sort of fascinating moment, and truth be told, that's a more of an sort of inductive guess on my part about that connection. But in December 1953, the magazine Stag, which is kind of a predecessor to Playboy, although it's a little bit more of a adventure magazine at the time, usually had menacing creatures on the cover, you know, attacking brave men. And the December 1953 issue has an orca attacking these two bare-chested guys on a life raft. You know, it's clearly about to devour them. And it's within months of that issue coming out that U.S. servicemen based in a NATO base in Iceland participate in an attack on orcas in Icelandic waters at the request of Iceland's government. And I think it's a fair guess that at least a number of those servicemen in Iceland might have seen that cover of Stag magazine.
Fascinating.
You know, within weeks of that, and they, you know, they end up over the next few years actually end up strafing and machine gunning probably hundreds of orcas in Icelandic waters. And so it's a bit of guesswork there, but it's, you know, a potential clear connection between sort of a media image and actual acts of violence.
Has that always been a fascination to you, or what do you think is the value of communicating and storytelling in our perception of a species like this, in a species where our perception has shifted so quickly in the grand scheme of history over just the last, I mean, in a matter of decades, really.
Someone who was trained in kind of media studies would have approached the story differently, and might have done a better, a more nuanced job with some of the media imagery and storytelling that I bring in. You know, I mean, obviously, as a historian, you know, I'm trying really hard to, you know, use those sources in a sensitive way and contextualize them. And it was really important for me to get as much of that material, including the visual sort of media images in for the readers to give a sense of, you know, how this imagery and how these perceptions are changing, and to utilize that with what I think, you know, comes more naturally to me, which is telling these stories of people and their transformations and their kind of their experiences, especially through, you know, oral history, which is a real sort of core of the book, is me sitting down with these people and hearing their stories. But what I will say is, you know, a big challenge to that is a lot of, you know, animal historians, if you could call them that, you know, people that are doing the you know, historians working on the human relations, history of human relations with animals, they will often focus on sort of the human, you know, the discourse, if you will, the imagery, the way that people construct images of animals and particular species as part of how we construct ourselves as humans. But the challenge for me was doing that and tracing this transformation of people's perceptions of this species, but at the same time, actually trying to tell at least give a sense of the lived experience of these killer whales themselves, you know, who are living creatures with their own cultures and choices and actions that we can't necessarily understand, but who's certainly affected history, affected their own history, affected human history. And I draw on science a lot for that. And so I'm trying to combine, I guess, you know, these very human sources, you know, media and such, and the narratives that people produce, which with their intersection with these orca stories that you know, I can't interview orcas, obviously, but I try to put together a lot of their lives and how they might have experienced this.
Yeah. But I mean, I think there's a Victor Sheffer quote in there that says, seeing them in aquariums individualize these creatures. They were no longer just whales in the abstract. And that, I mean, that alone kind of gets at what you're talking about. We can't entirely tell their stories, but if you have individual animals with individual things people are observing that are basically completely reshaping the way they think about a species, a ton of power in that.
Absolutely. And you know, if you know who Victor Sheffer was, the power of that becomes even more profound. You know, there's a guy that was, you know, at the Marine Mammal Biological Laboratory in Seattle, and his life's work really was managing and regulating the U.S. government's fur seal harvest in the Pribilof Islands, you know, so basically overseeing the slaughter and processing of tens of thousands of marine mammals. He also worked, as other scientists did there, with the commercial whalers that were working out of California. But then he goes on to be, you know, at the head of the Marine Mammal Commission, goes through his own transformation later in his career, you know, writes a book called Year of the Whale, which is still a celebrated book. And he himself, you know, becomes a critic of capture, even though most of his career was about killing. That shows, I love that quotation, because that comes, you know, long after he's retired, where he's actually reflecting on this transformation. And even he himself, who was critical of capture and captivity, is acknowledging the role that it played in even a scientist like him and his transformed perceptions.
You're talking specifically about someone like that, who is basically a human embodiment of that contradiction around this species.
Absolutely. And you know, it's definitely my conviction and the way that I practice history and the way I write to trust my readers with the connections that I help draw for them. It's not to club them over the head with sort of prescriptive, you know, analysis. And so, you know, I aimed for a book that was inviting to read and suggestive. And I don't really close it out with a prescription of what I demand that they take from it. But I did hope to, you know, unsettle some assumptions and hopefully encourage a shared sense of responsibility toward the, you know, not just an appreciation for the transformation and how rapid and complete it was in our relationship with orcas, but a sense of a shared responsibility for the marine ecosystem that nourishes us. And that's much more of a subtext of the book, but I try to model it through my family and you know, my family obviously being haunted by this and accepting the responsibility for its part in the damage. And you know, I'm trying to model that for readers as a way to for us to accept a regional responsibility for you know, these creatures that deserve to have a place here too, you know, and deserve to be able to make a living here too.
Yeah, a conversation I had a few days ago with Joe Gatos, our science director, whom you've met, who says hi, by the way, is like around something like, say Free Willy, a massive movie that has a big impact on the general cultural perception of killer whales, in a way that kind of, which is sort of indisputably a good one, right? Like people, it basically introduces a lot of people to the idea of captivity and elicits a lot of sympathy and empathy for this species. But that doesn't change the fact that a moment like that, a story like that, a thing to put in the culture like that, isn't possible without captive killer whales. That's just true, right?
Absolutely. It's, I mean, you know, for those that are old enough to remember, you know, Free Willy had a comparable impact to Blackfish, right? You know, they're 20 years apart, 1993 and 2013. One's a documentary, but Free Willy is a feature film. But you know, for those that saw it as kids, it's a really iconic film. Not just, you know, it opens with a montage of J-Pod, you know, the Southern Resident pod here. And then it actually sort of frames a lot of the understandings of this because, you know, those whales are captured by, you know, these kind of faceless, dastardly fishermen who are, you know, selling them to captivity. But the story itself, the kind of core story about this troubled teen who has this personal transformation and redemption through this close relationship with this orca. I mean, the paradox of the film is that's not possible without captivity, you know, and that's not to celebrate captivity. It's just to say that even a film that's on the face of it, heavily critical of captivity and ends with the improbable sort of leap to freedom that Willie has, even that is not possible without captivity. And the production of the film wasn't possible without captivity. Of course, it's done in mostly in Mexico, you know, at a captive facility. And the story itself relies upon captivity. I mean, you can't interact with orcas that closely in the wild. And what I find interesting about that is, you know, it's art imitating life in the sense that, you know, that's not unlike the transformations we see with Paul Spong and Bob Hunter, you know, whose close interactions with Scanna, who was a Southern Resident killer whale in the Vancouver Aquarium, proved so personally transformative to them that they become, you know, the shock troops in the anti-whaling campaign, especially against the Soviet Union. And, you know, in Hunter's case, you know, he just has one very close, well, he has a couple, but one really searing transformative moment with Scanna where she briefly grips his head with her teeth and then lets go. And he describes that as, you know, he writes about it as that's his moment of transformation. And it's hard to imagine those two becoming the kind of messiahs of the anti-whaling movement that they become, and including leading the way toward the moratorium in the 1980s without having that close encounter with Scanna. And I think that's something that historians can do well, which is trace these personal stories and make these connections and wrestle with these questions of contingency, you know, and because I think a lot of people, when they look at history, assume that what happened was inevitable. And so we just need to figure out why what was inevitable happened. But that's not actually how it works. I mean, history is full of nuances and contingency. And you know, one can ask the counterfactual of what would have happened if Paul Spong hadn't had the opportunity to work with Scanna.
Yeah, I find all of that endlessly compelling. And of course, it would be crazy to say Free Willy changed a lot of people's perception of captivity for the better. And therefore, it's a great case for why we should have more killer whale captivity. Right. That's crazy. But it doesn't mean that first statement isn't true. And it's the same thing for the Paul Spong and Scanna. And like, it's a running thread through the book. It's just, this is part of the history.
How intertwined captivity is with our knowledge and fondness of orcas in ways that we often want to deny. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you're weaved in with all of that is one particularly kind of haunting thing that I read that just has kind of stuck with me. So I typed it out is, I think you're talking about Lolita, the last remaining Southern resident in Florida, who has received a ton of news coverage and is I think a lot of people know Lolita's story is what does, I can't remember which researcher is looking at her in her tank, but it's like the tank, the condition is good, the water looks clean, yada, yada. But what does a life spent alone do to a complex social animal hardwired for acoustic stimulation? Do young orcas fear silence the way children fear the dark? This is an orca separated from her family while young in a tank in captivity. That's like haunting. That's a haunting thought.
Yeah, it's a great passage for illustrating what I meant when I said I couldn't have written this book until I was at a certain stage in life. And so that's a passage that I simply wouldn't have imagined penning until I was a father myself. And I did go to Miami with Ted Griffin. That's that scene where he's there with me. And this is the man who captured her, right? That scene took place in January 2016. So even then, that's 5 years ago almost, she had been in captivity for 45 years and almost 46 years. And I I certainly wrestled with how to understand that when I was there and how to write about it afterward. And I will say that, you know, my experience as a dad, you know, watching little human creatures, you know, come into the world and realize how important their families are to them and how they wrestle with their fears. It was hard not to see that. And that's partly what I mean by the breaking down of species barriers. And it's uncomfortable for scientists often, you know, to acknowledge that, you know, animals experience emotions or grieve, you know, their losses in a way akin to people. But I actually think it's a really useful exercise to make that leap. And so, yeah, that there were a lot of passages in this book, honestly, that left me crying afterwards. And that was one of them.
Yeah, it's a heavy thought. Okay, well, as we wind this down, I've really enjoyed this, by the way. It doesn't feel like the right way to ask to as we end this. Like, you talk about, like, what's our moral obligation? What do we owe them? Because, like you said, the population, I mean, who knows after a coronavirus pandemic what's going to happen with the populations of these massive city centers, but our human population in this area continues to rise. The kind of the chapter in our narrative with southern resident killer whales is now at, we have in the low 70s, generally trending downward over the last 20 years with, as we're covering in this podcast series, kind of threats coming at them from all directions. What's your, where do you land on moral obligation of people living in this area, or sort of just an individual human being listening to this podcast or reading your book, like going about their life?
It's a big question, but I have hopefully a way to answer that, you know, quickly. You know, as you said, it's important to remember that this is a population that recovered quite a bit into the late 1990s before they've crashed in the last 20 years. And that crash has nothing to do with captivity, at least directly, and everything to do with what's happened to their ecosystem in this growing area. This is a region that people move to or come to visit from all over, you know, North America and the world to be closer to nature, but that has an inevitable impact on nature, right? And I think that we tend to forget when we're living in cities how much our presence there as consumers, as polluters, displaces the very nature that we treasure, right? You know, just to give you a quick example, you know, people love going to the Pike Place Market to see that sort of cornucopia of seafood. And there's almost this this extravaganza and celebration of all the seafood that's available to consumers in Seattle. And I think people tend to forget that, you know, very little of the seafood that you see there is actually from Washington State. You know, it's mostly from, it's coming from, you know, lots of places, mostly Alaska, precisely because we've devastated and overfished and drained the Salish Sea of you know, its rich resources. And so when you look at orcas, at southern resident orcas in particular, who rely, you know, overwhelmingly on Chinook salmon runs, you're talking about a species that, you know, for it, a population that, you know, for thousands of years has had this reliable culture and understanding of where to find this food, and it's been very efficient. And in the blink of an eye, ecologically, we've changed that, even as we, you know, devastated their population. So the way I often think about this is, the southern resident killer whales are, in my mind, without question, the most significant and transformative population of cetaceans on the earth for their impact on humans, on human culture, on human history.
Yeah.
They profoundly changed us, but they paid an astonishingly high price and continue to pay an astonishingly high price for our mistakes and our education. And the only way to put that, I would say, is that we have a moral debt to them. And that debt, you know, there's lots of threats, you know, but for me, you know, at the core of that debt is an obligation that we have to make sure that they have enough to eat, enough for their offspring to eat, you know, a way to make a living in this space that we have denuded and polluted and emptied. And that for us means, you know, we shouldn't be catching, either for sport or for commercial gain, we shouldn't be catching local Chinook salmon runs until we know that they have enough to eat. You know, I grew up as a fisherman in Washington State. I know how iconic that is for people, but you know, this is the price we need to pay. You know, we need to think about removing dams that will help replenish those runs. And I guess the thought I always like to leave people with, because, you know, certainly for those who really care about the environment, and especially for kids growing up who are worried about, you know, climate change and environment, it's really important to give people hope as opposed to just spreading, you know, this dark, horrible news. All is lost. Yeah. But, and I would really emphasize that, you know, that we have seen that nature can heal if we give it space and time. And that's true of the southern resident orcas, and that's true of, you know, salmon runs. If we just, you know, let some of these rivers heal and return to closer to their natural state, you know, nature can heal if we give it a chance. It's that we keep it under siege that sort of creates these sort of this dark pessimism. But it really can, we can turn things around.
Well, this was a huge pleasure to talk to you, and really enjoyed the book. The book is called Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. Where can people find more about you, Jason?
I'm probably not a very good self-promoter in the sense that, you know, I have my website on the University of Victoria, you know, where I'm professor and chair of the Department of History. You can find a bit more about me there. And you can certainly look up the book at Oxford University Press's website as well.
Very cool. Well, enjoyed this, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you so much.
Visit seadocsociety.org to get our newsletter or to support marine science in the Salish Sea. We have a ton going on this spring, so definitely follow along there and on social media so that you don't miss out on any of it. Our logo was created by float.org, and all music was created by Poddington Bear. Thank you.